You know, normally we start off the show showing the folks something we got from the garden, but it's been mighty wet at my house, so I didn't pick anything for this week's show. But what I did want to tell everybody about, I wanted to talk about these boots right here.
Boots?
These old dirty boots right here. Before I do that, let's go ahead and say hey to everybody, and we'll get into this. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Row by Row Garden Show. We're excited to have you with us tonight. Excited to have you joining us, whether it be on Facebook or YouTube. Got a really good show planned. We're going to talk a little bit about market farming later on. But before we get to that, got a couple things I want to mention. So, if you watch my videos, my gardening attire, usually you got your overalls. I like to wear my shorts and my rubber boots. And for the longest time, I was a big fan of the Muck boots, the Muck brand boots. Within the last year or so, I noticed the quality on those went downhill big time.
Yes, I have too. Mine's always split right up here, and I hadn't bought any Muck boots in the last couple of years because I just couldn't get, they just wouldn't last for me.
Mine would start messing up right down here, and I'm notoriously rough on a pair of boots.
I am too.
So if I can get a year out of a pair, I got a boot budget of about $100, $150 a year. If I can get a year out of a pair, I'm doing good. Now, I like the slip-ons because I could be in the garden 1 second, knee-deep, and the next second need to go in the house and tend to the youngin. So I need to be fast with my boot swapping on.
Because them boys can get in trouble in a hurry.
That's right. So that's why I like these. So I wore the Mucks for a while, but I got where I couldn't even get 8 months out of a pair. So I saw some folks recommending these. And this is a newer brand out there called Dry Shod. And they make several different styles. I like the kind of ankle high ones. And this one is called the Sod Buster. Now they are a little bit heavier than the Muck boots. They come in right around the same price range. They just wear a little different, but I've gotten used to them and I really like them. And it just feels like a better made boot there.
And the name is?
Dry Shod is the company.
D-R-I-S-H-O-D.
Yeah, you can find them online.
Yep. Expensive?
About a little over $100. Same kind of price range as the Muck boot was. But I've liked them so far. So found a good substitute to the... And I don't know what happened with Muck. If they sold out to somebody, they started making them somewhere else. But I've heard from a lot of people that they...
they don't last for me either. I've worn many a Muck boot, but we don't get the wear out of them either.
What else is going on? It's wet.
It's wet. It's that middle of the time. We got a little lull in the garden. I'm doing my cleanup. I got my garden cleaned up. And man, have I got some pretty sunflowers and zinnias. I got the prettiest crop of zinnias coming along that I've had. I actually planted some individual colors. And they're, as we speak, are starting these buds out there. And they started opening and blooming. So I got some colors that I got separated that I'm really excited about. I got the... color of, I got it's a kind of a burgundy color. What is that?
A wine, maybe?
Wine, something similar to that. And then I blew the lime.
The lime.
I got a patch of lime and I got a coral. That's what I got, coral planted. So I'm really excited about those. Man, I got them. My mix is dying out. I got some sunflowers coming along. I just am starting in the greenhouse some new coxcombs. So I'm going to plant some coxcombs. So let me say this a little bit about cut flowers. It's not too late to still grow some cut flowers. I just talked to my friend Lisa and listened to her webinar the other night. 8 weeks before your last frost date, if you don't know what your last frost date is, you definitely need to go on the computer and type it in. You can put your zip code in or several different things and find out what your last frost date is for your area. And you've got maximum, maybe you got 8 weeks from that last frost date that you can get sunflowers in the ProCut series. So you can back that up and you can get sunflowers all the way in, plant them all the way in up to 8 weeks of the last frost date and still get some pretty blooms off. Zinnias probably the same way, if not quicker. So you got plenty of time left to get some cut flowers in. I'm just, you know, we're in zone 8. Our average frost date here is November 20th. So I got plenty of time, and I'm starting all kind of new stuff for fall blooming flowers.
I got you. I've been cover cropping pretty hard, and I had a video come out Wednesday showing kind of an update. Sorghum sedans looking good. I got the tarp on my sun hemp. In that video, we planted some millet and some buckwheat, in two separate pots. My millet's looking real good. The buckwheat where I planted that is coming up good, except for it's in the lowest spot of the new Dream Garden, and all this, we've been getting at least an inch a day for the last 6 days. So I'm currently growing some hydroponic buckwheat.
Buckwheat don't like wet feet. It don't like, it likes dry ground.
So we'll see, and there's a couple wet spots there that's been holding water, and I might not get quite as good a stand as anticipated, but we'll make it work.
Oh yeah.
What else we got going on? Cucumbers, I got the best crop of cucumbers I've ever grown this year.
I ate me a mess of your cucumbers last night. They were good.
Where'd you get them from?
Miss Hall stole them.
Oh yeah?
She said she snitched a few when she was at your house yesterday.
Oh, okay, okay.
Maybe not should have told you that, but she did.
I was wondering, I picked them last night, and I usually get a whole 5 gallon bucket full, and I was short a few, so
they were good.
That explains what happened. Yeah, somebody on Instagram was asking me if these gynoecious varieties tend to get bitter late in the season, and I haven't noticed.
I have not either.
My wife told me, she said, I believe them's the best tasting cucumbers
you've
ever grown.
They are really good. And they're pretty. They was nice, and no blemishes on them. They look like number ones.
Good texture on them. Good texture on them. What else? We talked about last week, got a lot of new seeds coming in. I want to show everybody this right here.
Man, I'm excited some of these new seeds we got coming in. We're doing some things that this. A little different. We got some onion. Look at those pelleted. See, now these are pelleted. What are these?
These carrots.
These are carrots.
So that's a new variety of carrots we got called Deep Purple. And that's 100,000 pelleted carrot seeds. And we got a lot more where that come from. So we're working on getting our seed packets printed for these. We'll get these packed up, get them on the site, and they'll be ready for fall.
Onion seed, leek seed. We got all that coming.
That's right. That's right.
Good. We're working stuff on there. That as we speak.
So if you live in the South and have a hard time getting onion plants as early as you need them, early November, stuff like that, we're going to have the resources with our seed starting trays and the onion seed and the leek seed.
We happen to have a little in on the Vidalia onion growers. And the same place the Vidalia onion growers buy their seed, we have an end, we can get those same seeds, and we're going to offer them to people for the home gardener. So if you want to grow those sweet onions, got you covered.
And what a lot of people don't realize is what the Vidalia onion, that just means it was grown in Vidalia. There's actually about 20 to 25 different varieties they might use from 1 year to the next.
But the characteristics of that onion is pretty similar. I mean, when people think by day, they think about a particular type of onion, and we got that onion covered.
Yeah, so we're going to have two, quote, kind of Vidalia-like varieties. The other thing with leeks, we got leek plants from Dixondale last year, but they don't start shipping those till January. But we can grow leeks in the fall like crazy.
Oh, yeah.
So the ability to grow our own leek plants and not have to wait till January, we can get another probably two crops off of one in fall and one starting at the end.
A lot of exciting things coming with seeds for the next 6 months, and then next year we'll even have more. We're working on that hard as we go about adding a lot of different stuff and unique stuff. We're going to have some things nobody else has.
That's right. That's right. One final update, my cats. So I talked about last week getting some cats, and we found two grown cats at the Humane Society. We rescued them. I put them in the chicken tractor. They was doing good. We was going to leave them in there a few days so they could acclimate.
Pumpkin and Chloe.
And go out there Sunday night to check on them. And they'd been working on it a little bit, but
they escaped.
Pumpkin shot out right through the wire like somebody running through a wood door of that chicken tractor. And they turn loose, and we've seen them shadows at night, but they hadn't really been sticking around a whole lot. But I haven't seen any more rats eating on my cucumbers or causing troubles in my drip tape. So while they're not present in the fact that we can see them, I like to think that they're out there roaming around somewhere doing what we got them to do.
I'm sure they are. They're roaming around somewhere. I just hope it ain't too far away, but maybe it'll work out for you.
Anyway, we rescued them from the Humane Society that turned them loose, and they out living
the good life.
Living the good life now. So, all right. So this week, or last week we talked about, we asked the question, did y'all want to hear a little bit more about the market farming deal, kind of what I'm doing. And we're actually going to break this up into two different shows because there's a lot to talk about here. So this week, we're going to talk about kind of the history of market farming and some of kind of the current big names out there that's doing a lot of promotion of trying to get people to start market farming. And the next show, I want to talk, we'll talk more about my specific model and what's worked in this area. So you want to give a little, you used to do a little, wasn't called market farming, but a little produce running back in the day.
Well, the agricultural has changed a lot in the last 30 years, and I've seen it firsthand. I actually grew up in the produce business, so I was aware of the way it was back in the day. And I'm going to say back in the day, in the 70s and the 80s, we was heavily involved in it. Then I kind of moved over into that, more into horticultural, and then stayed in agriculture somewhat, and then back and forth. So I have a lot of history back with the way things used to be done, and I've firsthand seen the progression of the way things have evolved. Now, it's easy to sit here and say things have evolved for the worse, and they have in some aspects. They've also evolved for the better in a lot of different aspects. Back in the day, there was a lot of people who had a lot of small farms, and farms were a lot more diversified than what they are now. That's kind of a bad thing in my thing. The diversification back then allowed the farmers to be more, you know, they could do a lot of different, they did a lot of different stuff. And if they had a failure, one, the other one could pick it up. And there was a lot of different things available back then that are not now. So diversification has not evolved. Example, back in the day, everybody that was a small farmer had an acre or half acre of tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And it was a cash crop for them. So they had that, you know, that they could depend on. They would have a few acres or cantaloupes, watermelons, four or five, and, you know, scattered around everywhere. Well, that type system is gone now. If you grow tomatoes now, you grow several hundred acres. You have to have a packing shed. The use of plaster culture has evolved where it wasn't back in the 70s and 80s. Watermelons the same way. You don't grow 5 acres of watermelons anymore. People around here grow hundreds of acres of them.
Right.
So, and then they have crews that come in and harvest them. It's just, it's evolved a long way from where it used to be.
Back in the day, they used to call it truck farming.
Truck farming.
Because you basically sold everything out the bed of your truck.
Yep.
You still hear that terminology used nowadays, but most people use the term market farm. Before we get into some of the kind of today's models, I want to talk about certification a little bit because we had a few people ask about that. My farm itself, I'm not organic certified. And there's several different certifications out there you can get. There's the organic certification, and then there's one called naturally grown.
You're exempt, by the way, on the organic certification if you grow and sell less than $5,000 per year.
Right.
You can still use the organic term and not have to be certified because you're exempt if you fit into that threshold of less than $5,000 per year in sales.
Right. And then my personal opinion on the certification that it was is that at one point in time back in the past, it served a really good purpose. Once the government got a hold of it, it became a little bit of a money grab. And some of the things that are not allowed in the certification and some things that are allowed, I'm not really, they don't make a lot of sense to me. Why some, it, anyway, so we choose not to be certified, and our customers understand that we take good care. We're growing our food and don't do anything we shouldn't be doing to.
Organic is actually, when we talk about organic, it's actually a growing practice. And people need to understand it in that form and you'll understand, you'll gather it a little bit better. Back in the day when you mentioned, and this was back in the 80s, when you mentioned organic and you could talk to farmers, anybody, nobody knew what it meant. They meant, they thought when you mentioned organic that it meant growing food without any inputs. That was the common misconception everybody had. Well, it's not. I mean, you actually have inputs put into organic production, but it is a growing practice, the way things are grown.
It's more about nurturing the soil, being good stewards of the soil, mm-hmm. having the soil be a living organism itself.
Right.
Okay, let's talk about some of the sales models out there nowadays that a lot of people use. And we follow, excuse me, we follow several market farming groups on Facebook. And we used to do quite a few trade shows that were specifically geared to market farmers. So we've seen a little bit of this in action. The first model you've got is your CSA.
Community Supported Agriculture, and it really caught on and bloomed. I think the first time I heard it was about 10 years ago. 10 to 15 years ago, this model really took it on and started growing and started doing well. And there's certain people out there that have really done well with it, and certain people out there that do not like this type of system.
Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of this system as it originally came about, for mainly one reason. So with the CSA model, as it kind of started, the way it works is you buy shares at the beginning of the season, and then that farmer delivers those shares throughout the growing season. So you're paying up front for something that you may or may not get, because there's a stipulation in there that if there's a crop failure or something, you don't get your money back.
And hence the name, you're supporting community agriculture.
Right. And I'm kind of a big believer in
performance.
Delivering, and so I don't believe in you should collect money up front and then not give anything back, even if you have a crop failure. So that's just my personal opinion on the CSA. I understand some upstart farmers need that money to get their seed bought and stuff like that. Heck, even these huge farmers around here loan their, you know, get a loan for their seed. So I understand the economics of that, but it just, I don't know, it just doesn't sit well with me.
Okay.
The second kind of monetary model is the farmer's market.
Now these have changed over a period of time. Back in the day, we used to have the state-owned farmer's markets, and that's where everything happened at. Well, nowadays they've evolved, and especially these bigger towns will put in these farmer's markets for Saturday, Sunday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and they can be anywhere. And to give you an example, we went to a couple up in Dayton, Ohio that was really nice. They had food places in there. They open every weekend, and they have all kind of small vendors in there that sell produce, cheese, meats, and stuff like that to support a small farmer. And these really work good in a lot of different circumstances. And, of course, there's some failures out there. But in these bigger towns, these seem to work. The ones I've been to seem to work really well.
Yeah, but with the farmer's market, you've got to have the people, the community to support it. Here, we don't have a very good farmer's
From my experience, they seem to work better in highly populated areas.
More affluent areas.
Yep.
Rural areas, it can be kind of tough.
It can be tough.
There's one in Tipton up the road here, a smaller one that does okay, but one of the problems there is... you know, if you're going to have small-scale growers there, you don't need to let pin hookers in there as well. You want to tell them pin hookers?
Pin hookers, somebody that buys the product and brings it in. And when every time you go to a farmer's market and somebody's got pineapple and mangoes and things like that, then you can go ahead and write them down as a pin hooker because they bought that product and bring it in there. A true farmer's market is somebody that grow that product and then bring it and sell it.
Right, right. So...
I always get tickled when I go in a farmer's market and see somebody with pineapples and mangoes, things
right.
like that.
So you'd like to have, in theory, you'd like to have one where everything being sold there was grown by the person who's selling
right.
it. And then there's also to the market farming deal, there's also a wholesale aspect of it where some people will sell to restaurants or a larger produce stand, or even some like these little country stores. We have one of those we work with from time to time.
Now, your model is a little bit different from all those, and we're not going to get into it today, but it's a little bit different from all those, and we'll touch on that later. But let me say that the three that we discussed, the CSA, the farmer's market, and the wholesale aspect of it, what I have found is some work for some and some doesn't. So really what it boils down to on those three different models is figuring out which one works for you and give it your go. And sometimes you have to test and see which one's gonna work best.
Right, so my model is close to a CSA, but different. We don't do any farmer's markets because doing the math, the time it would take me to pack up everything, I'd have to make $1,000 or so on one morning for it to be worth the time doing all that. And we just don't have that kind of market around here to do that. There's plenty of them out there where people are making good money on a Saturday morning.
Yeah.
We do a little bit of wholesale. We'll talk about all that next week. So the popularity of the market farming really started booming with a few authors, a few kind of figureheads out there really started promoting the practice.
Different models. And one that we go back to that I've read a lot of books on, I have actually had the opportunity to sit down with him and have some one-on-one conversations, Elliot Coleman. I think he was the forefather of setting up the way some of these things work.
Yeah, and we got several of his books there we still carry on our website. This is the Winter Harvest Handbook. I think that's his most recent. He's got this one, the Four Season Harvest. So he's up there in Maine, and I think this was his original book that's kind of a lot of people still use as kind of a textbook and handbook.
I've read several of his books, and they're very good.
He's all about year-round production, using high tunnels, those types of things. Not a big fan of his soil blocking technique, but besides that, he's got some really good stuff out there.
He has, and one thing that he's really done, he's zeroed in on money-making crops, the crops that actually perform well for him and make money. And he explains why he grows certain things because they're money makers, and why he didn't certain other things. So,
and then behind him came along, when was this book published, do you know?
It's been out a few years. Guy up in Canada called J.M.
Fourth print, 2015 was the most recent printing. So J.M. Fortier, who's up in Canada, had this book, The Market Gardener, and we're actually mentioned in this book. He kind of started talking about a lot of equipment. He's got a very specific system he uses. He's a big fan of using the broad fork for his beds, which works great in some soil types. So he came along, and then not far behind him was a guy named Curtis Stone. And Curtis, his big thing was doing this market farming in the city, in these urban areas. Basically, he would borrow a neighbor's lot and give them some food in return, and he would grow food for market on those lots. And he kind of figured out how to do it in real small spaces.
Grows a lot of greens and lettuces and kales, things like that.
Yeah.
Very intensive gardening or farming.
Right. And he's up in Vancouver, and Curtis got a really big YouTube channel.
Yep. The upcoming is a guy called, what's the guy's name?
His name's Connor. I can't remember his last name.
Never Seen Farm. They're up and comers in this aspect.
They're in New England somewhere.
New England. They're doing really good. They do a lot of content, and they're doing well.
Yeah, and they're also, one of their big claims is the weed-free farm, which we know doesn't exist, but something we aspire to. And they put in a lot of practices to keep weeds at a very minimum so they don't waste a lot of labor removing the weeds.
And here again, we've actually had a conversation with JM, and we talked about some of the, you know, way they do things. And all these guys have found systems work for them, but they have a totally different environment than what we have. They have a different environment. They have a different market than what we have. Mm-hmm. And what they do works for them and good for them. And their books and their, you know, their stuff that they write is good information. However, it didn't always work where you're at. And we live down here in the Deep South. We have challenges that they don't have. We have opportunities that they don't have. So when we read their book, don't ever take anything, you know,
as an absolute
truth. It always changes. And we can see some of the things. And we've tried some things that they've done before and they work. Mm-hmm. But by no means does everything they do work for us.
Right. And just to give you a couple examples, I was talking to JM at a Mother Earth News show one time about his 30-inch bed system. I said, man, we just grow a wider diversity of crops. Doesn't really work for that system. I said, you can't grow corn, or it's a waste of space to grow corn on a 30-inch bed. He said, well, nobody grows corn anymore. Well, maybe not where he's at, but you market farm down here, you better have you some corn.
Yeah.
Some sweet corn. There's different things there. And let's talk about some of these popular techniques and maybe why they don't work. And before I get into that, one more thing I just thought of, talking about the corn. He don't sell much corn. We might sell a lot of corn. Those greens, those mixed greens mixes that they sell the fire out of, $4 or $5 a pound.
We can't hardly
give them away.
Right.
I like them. I enjoy eating them and growing them, but it's just not a big seller. So your market has a lot to do with it.
Yep, it does.
Some of the popular techniques out there nowadays, you got the 30-inch raised bed system. I understand why some people do that. It doesn't work for me because I grow so many different things that 30-inch bed works great for greens, brassicas, carrots, stuff like that. Not as well for pumpkins or corn or some other things, mm-hmm. okra.
Heavy composting. They do a lot of heavy composting. They have a lot richer soil than we do down here. Us living in the South, we like to incorporate compost and carbon in our soils, but they burn up real quick. And we don't have the opportunity to have the real rich soils that they do up there.
Right. We can add just as much compost as they do.
But it'll burn out.
But it'll burn out and our soil will look like sand. Whereas you see their videos and their content, it just looks like this dark, rich stuff because it's not burning up as quick as ours mm-hmm. is. The broad forking is another thing that a lot of them do. I don't have a problem with compaction as much. They do that with the 30-inch beds to kind of keep the beds aerated without tilling them and maintain the shape of it and everything.
I'm not a huge fan of the broad fork.
I'm not either. The intensive growing, which is a great practice, and we use a lot of that. Growing as much as you can in a given space. You shade out the area, keep weeds from growing, really maximize
your space. All those guys have done a really good job in that aspect of it.
Yeah. One thing I'll never understand that they do is surface drip tape.
Yep.
And I think that they're the reason why all these people who are new to drip tape think it's supposed to go on top of the soil. So I don't understand that aspect.
If you're looking for it, you can have a disaster that way growing it on top of soil. Where we live, wind can blow it around, the rats get into it. We just bury it, put it out of the way, and don't have any problems.
Right. And it's easy to pull up. It's just lots of pluses to do.
So I am privy to a little information that I thought I would share today. I have access to a website that gives weekly info on the large farmers, on the produce buyers and things like that.
Okay, sure.
So what is the number one product that is sold in grocery store that's organic?
I don't know. Tell us.
Kale,
that makes sense.
Kale is the number one product. These tomatoes was on down the line, but I thought it was interesting. Kale was the number one product that people reach for organically over any other product.
So you're talking about if you're comparing side by side organic versus conventional, kale is the one where they pick organic the most.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying of all the organic produce, kale is sold more organically than any other thing. So I'm not saying that they sell more organic kale than they do conventional. I'm saying out of all the organic spectrum, kale is the number one seller.
Okay.
Another thing that when we look at the trend in big grocery stores and produce, things like that, is value added, making it more convenient with these sizes. If you notice, they've really gotten good at putting small produce in little bags so you can buy these individual things
and label the package,
label and all that, and value added where it's already cut up. I've seen squash and cucumbers already sliced up and they sell them that way. That's the new trend. So within the last week, you're gonna find this really interesting because I did. The three items out there that the produce people, the large produce buyers, were the most interested in. Now this doesn't mean that this products were the most sought after because of volume, but this means that these niche items were the most sought after because they were harder to get.
Demand was higher.
Demand was higher because they couldn't get it.
Right.
It didn't mean that the volume was higher. The number one was figs. Mm-hmm. Ain't that interesting? Figs. But you know, if you think about it, if you go to your grocery store, it's really hard. There's not a lot of fig farmers out there. Mm-hmm. Number two was okra.
Okra. Mm-hmm.
Now, number three didn't surprise me a whole lot. Number three was cucumbers.
Right.
But the number one, figs and okra, being the two most sought after commodities in the produce industry within the last week. That goes to show you, if you are thinking about growing that some of these niche products out there, they are opportunities in.
Yeah. And I don't know that I've ever seen in our local Publix ever seen okra in there. Now, some of the smaller little grocery stores will have some okra, and you can find some at the farmer's market, but big chain stores, you don't usually see okra there.
That's right.
Figs either.
Figs either.
Certainly.
I have seen them there, but not on a regular basis.
All right, that's good stuff. Let's, before we close out this week's Market Farmer Talk, I do want to talk about a few common issues I see with people trying to get started in this arena. The first one, and this is probably the biggest one I see, you got a lot of people out there that they work a desk job and they think they see these videos of people growing food, selling food. They want to be a market gardener, but they've never grown a garden in their life.
Dreamers. And nothing wrong with the dreamer.
Nothing wrong with the dreamer. And you can read all these books you want to read and develop all the systems you want. But until you've actually got out there and grown food, it's going to be a challenge for you. So anybody that's wanting to get into market farming, I would take some time, maybe even a few, several years, 4 or 5 years, learn how to grow food for yourself and your neighbors first, and then scale it up to where you can sell it.
Hone your system down.
Yeah.
Find out what you're good at growing.
I don't jump in too deep, because even folks have been doing it like us a while, we still have failures all the time.
Yep.
The second problem I see is people get too bogged down in the schematic details of it. Farming can be very variable, or highly variable. So especially with like JM systems and the 30-inch bed systems, the main point of that is folks they want people to be able to nail down how much seed you're going to need to grow this many pound of radish or this many pound of carrots. And they want to really just analyze the fire out of it and just nitpick it to death. Well, the problem is things don't always turn out. Your carrots might not get as big as you thought they were. Things don't always work out that way. So getting your seed cost down to the exact seed and all this stuff,
do the best you can and move on.
You're going to spend too much time trying to figure all that out instead of being outside and being observant and understanding what's going on. The third one here I see, market farming is tough to do as a full-time gig. It's easy and fun to do as a side gig, but it's going to be hard to make a decent living doing it as a full-time gig. Not saying it can't be done. There's plenty of people out there doing it. But start off doing it as a side gig, and then if you can scale it up to a full-time gig, go for that. The last one, and we see this with my operation, growing the food is not the hard part. Marketing the food, getting people to buy it, is the hard part.
That's true in just about any business.
Yeah, so while growing it can be tough, that's not the hardest part. Finding people who will buy it on a consistent, regular basis and marketing the product is going to be your biggest challenge.
And selling that at a margin that you have profit in.
Right, right.
So we got a couple questions.
We do got a couple questions this week. And if we answer your question this week, send us an email to cusserve@hosstools.com with your address. We'll be glad to send you a nice little prize.
Clint Hutchinson asks, great show. When are y'all going to start your collards and kale plants?
It's funny that he asked that, because I actually have kale and collards still making from that I planted way back in the beginning of the year. They're about 3 foot tall. And I did several videos on those, but I'm thinking about doing another one. But I will get those out of the way just because I like to start with a fresh crop. End of August, early September is usually when we start those. They can handle a little bit of heat, so we'll get them started towards the end of August, early September, and then grow them. They'll grow and grow and grow all through the winter.
First of October is my prime time. I think that's the prime time to put them in for me.
To put them in or to start the seeds?
No. Well, you could start the seeds.
So if you start the seeds at the end of August, you're going to be putting them in the ground probably first of October.
Yeah, October's a good time, because it gives some time to get a good established before you have some frost. And we all know once you have a little frost on those greens, they seem to taste a little bit better.
Right, right.
So that's a good time here in Zone 8 is to make sure you got them in the ground between October 1st and 15th.
So if you're direct seed, aim for beginning of October. If you're transplanting, start working in August.
Yep.
All right. And our second question is from, let's see if I pronounce this right, Chanyada Farm.
Chanyada.
And they want to know, where does all of your knowledge come from? All of it.
Wow.
All of it. Do you have any formal schooling in agriculture, or is this all years of experience and research?
That's a loaded question there.
Yeah.
So I'll answer mine. I'll let you answer yours.
Okay.
Mine goes back years and years and years and years and years, way more than I want to admit. I've been in the industry one way, form, or fashion for a long time, and I've seen a lot of different parts of it. I've had some training in entomology. I've had some training, a lot of training.
Entomology is a study of insects.
Study of insects. Disease. I've done a lot of study of disease a lot.
Pathology.
On my own, mind you, and I've had some certifications that I've gained along the way back in the day in agronomy and also in horticulture. But I've been in it and I've seen a lot of it hands-on. I've done some consulting back in the day, had some different type companies that specialize in all this kind of stuff. So I get mine from the School of Hard Knocks.
School of Hard Knocks. And myself, I'm formally educated. I have a bachelor's and a master's in biology, and then I studied at the PhD level for about 4 years. So we have a good combination of formal education and informal education that allows us to integrate those two together.
Have some interesting conversations sometimes.
That's right. And we grow food year round and have been doing it for quite a while. So a lot of it is just getting out there and playing and teaching. I test the boundaries of what I can do every year, try to plant lettuce earlier or try to do this later or earlier, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So the only way you can learn sometimes is just to try.
Just do it.
All right, so good show. We'll mention we're early next week going to dig off to Grand Rapids, Michigan for a little meeting of the minds up there. Go meet with, go talk with the Sweet Potato Boys. We'll go see Bruce and the Onion folks up there and some other folks in our industry. So next week, we're not posting any videos. We're going to take the week off next week. So no two-minute tip, no Wednesday video, no row by row. No Gardner and Greg. I know that makes everybody upset, but they give you time to go back and watch some reruns, catch up on any that you might have missed. So we will see you guys in 2 weeks on the Row by Row show.
Yep.
And in the meantime, hope everybody has a good week.
Have a good one.